Just wanted to officially welcome you to the retreat. I hope you're happy to be here. I am happy to be here. I think we can call up our speaker. If you do remember, Pastor Thomas Wong did come about 2 years ago, and I hope you're excited to have him back. I am excited to have him back, and I look forward to hearing hearing a lot of the stories that he has to share about what God's been doing at his church, at Point Community Church in New Brunswick, New Jersey. And yes, New Jersey. Yes, so we will be having him for a number of sessions throughout this weekend. And yeah, I don't want to take up more of his time, so I'll just call him up. And I'm glad we actually got you a microphone.
It's good to be back with you guys here. It's been 2 years. I can't believe time passes so quickly. Just out of curiosity for me, how many of you guys here, this is your first retreat? I'm just kind of curious. Raise your hand. This is your first retreat? Okay. So you weren't here 2 years ago when I was here? Okay. So the majority of you guys were here 2 years ago, and I certainly recognize a number of faces. I guess I didn't do such a horrible job that Pastor Albert decided not to invite me back, so that's a good thing. That's a good thing. I have one thing that I've been dying to find out all week long since Evan sent out an email, and I think all of you got this, about the allergy warnings. You guys got the email from Evan about the allergy warnings, which was very thoughtful, by the way. You wanted to make sure that nobody ate anything that would kill them. The only thing that I was really curious about, and I've been dying all week to find out, was who is allergic to, I mean, like, did you read Evan's email? Look, did you guys read it carefully? I thought this was great, and I've been dying to find this out all week, and so I just lost it. I needed to ask this before we went any further. Here we go. Allergy warnings. Known food allergies in our church off the top of my head. Peanuts, that's pretty common. Shellfish, some people are allergic to shellfish. Bananas, a little bit more rare, but I guess some people are allergic to bananas and they can't eat that. But cats. I'm kind of curious who's allergic to this food known as cats. I'm just kind of curious who in your church is not allergic to the food called cats. I've been dying to find out all week. If you're allergic to eating cat, I'd like to know who you are. Because the rest of us apparently aren't allergic to eating cats. It's good to be back with you guys again. And as I was talking to Justin, was it Justin I was talking to? You gave me a call. Justin, you called me from Indonesia? No, from Thailand. We were talking through the retreat theme, and so let me tell you a little bit of kind of what happened. So when Pastor Albert and I were talking about ideas for this retreat and so on, I guess the idea of loving the Lord with all your heart and your mind and your strength and all your soul, that was kind of like where we were going. And I guess we must have talked about that back in December or January. And then as I was preparing and working on the messages and so on, I must have lost track a little bit of that. And I kind of focused more on the second part of the Great Commandment, which is to love your neighbor as yourself. And that's kind of where I really started to sense God leading me towards and addressing that issue in our lives. And the reason why I did that was this. Many of you will be familiar with the letter of 1 John. And in this letter of 1 John, he reiterates again and again and again. And I just want to read it to you because I think this helps us to set a context of where we're going to go this weekend in this weekend's messages. Because while we sing these songs that talk about loving God with all of our heart, and it's really easy to conceptualize what it means and what it looks like and why we would love God with all of our hearts, I want us to be very, very clear what loving God with all of our heart looks like, because John brings this out in his letter, particularly in 1 John. But listen to what he says. Dear friends, let us love one another, for love comes from God. Everyone who loves has been born of God and knows God. Whoever does not love does not know God, because God is love. This is how God showed his love among us. He sent his one and only Son into the world that we might live through him. This is love. Not that we love God, but that he loved us and sent his son as an atoning sacrifice for our sins. Dear friends, since God so loved us, we also ought to love one another. No one has ever seen God, but if we love one another, God lives in us, and his love is made complete in us. And when he writes that statement, but if we love one another, right? That's a conditional clause there. It's a really, really important concept for us to grasp, because loving God whom we have not seen with our physical eyes, loving God who really doesn't get on our last nerves, who doesn't cut us off in traffic, who doesn't, you know, isn't late in getting us the information that we need, who isn't an obstacle, you know, to my professional development. Loving a God who, quote unquote, does not inconvenience me in many of the ways that I think of is an easy thing to do. But loving people who get on my last nerves and who are oftentimes an obstacle or an impediment to me is a much, much more difficult thing. But John makes it very clear that love for God and love for people are inextricably linked together. In fact, God makes it very clear that if you don't love the people whom I have placed in your life, it's very, very disingenuous, actually, to say that you love God. He makes the two inseparable. And so we know what it is, and it's easy to love God because, man, he gave his one and only son as an atoning sacrifice for our sins. It's not difficult to love somebody that is that sacrificial to us. But man, loving the people that God has placed in our lives, that's a different story. Don't ask me to love those folks. And part of the reason why I decided to kind of spend some time going down this track was 2 years ago when I was here, apparently, when we started thinking a little bit about what it means for us to be a people who are on mission with God, being the hands and the feet and the heart and the face and the voice of Jesus in the community, in the spheres of influence that he's placed us in. We talked about that under this concept of being missional and living missionally and not thinking of missions as something that the few elite, spiritually dedicated and mature people, you know, do by going overseas. And I've always grown up thinking of mission with an S at the end of it, that just a few select individuals that are really committed, they go and do. But the rest of us, we just simply do our job, pay the bills, support the ministry, and support those who are going to do missions. And I think that's a very, very huge misunderstanding of the Great Commission, because our life actually is to be missional in all of those sphere of influences that God's placed us in. And so we started talking about that a couple of years ago, and I know that some of you guys have been going through Mike Breen's church and trying to unpack more and more what it means to follow God and be on mission with him in those sphere of influence. And so what I wanted to do this weekend was that kind of maybe step back and rather than just think more strategically and analytically about how do we be more missionally engaged, I kind of want to address maybe some of the heart matters, because if you have been on mission with God, if you have been intent and committed, intentional about being missional in the spheres of influence God has placed you in, you're going to come across people that are just simply unlovely and unlikable. And you're going to work with some people who are going to get on your last nerve. And what do you do then when you hit that roadblock? So I kind of wanted to unpack that a little bit, because I think it's not just about getting a job done. It's not just about coming in worship and being reminded about our love for God. I think our love for God is practically, tangibly, intentionally, and in some ways very challengingly demonstrated in our ability and in the way that we can love the people that God has placed in our lives. And God, and get this, folks, God places difficult people in your life on purpose. He places difficult situations and puts you in difficult circumstances on purpose. It is not by accident. And sometimes we think we would be such a better Christian. We would be so much further along in our spiritual journey and maturity if some of those people who are just a real pain in my neck wouldn't be in my life, if I could just move past them, if I can get rid of them, if they didn't exist, if they would just simply go to another church, if they would move to another city, if they weren't on my ministry team, if they weren't, you know, serving alongside of me, if I just simply changed my ministry and didn't have to see that person anymore on Sunday or on Fridays or whenever, life would be so much better and I could really enjoy my relationship with God. I would really be able to sing honestly and genuinely and feel like this love and connection with God. Let me tell you, folks, that's a very, very basic misunderstanding of what it means to love God, because that is the way through which God wants us to develop our love for him. And so that's where I want to spend this weekend, and I hope that as we go down this journey, it will be a weekend where some issues in your heart will be brought to the surface, and you'll have an opportunity to confront and potentially resolve some things that perhaps has built up in your life over time that in reality is keeping you from being able to love the Lord your God with all of your heart, all your mind, all of your soul, and all of your strength. Because there are some relational obstacles in your life that's preventing you from doing that. And perhaps there are some people that are in your way that's actually preventing you from being able to live missionally. Because if you are going to be on mission with God sooner or later, you're going to come across people that are difficult to love and that are unlikable. So let's dive in. If there's one word that I would use to characterize life in the modern world, and particularly I think in a major city, in a metropolitan area like New York City, any city, in fact, I think America, our culture, I think it would be the word disposable. I think we live in a disposable culture. The pace at which we live our lives has fueled a whole new world of products that can be used once and then trashed. From plates to cutlery to cameras to, I mean, diapers to, I mean, on and on and on. Everything that we have is increasingly designed to be disposed. Now, in one sense, that should lead us to be thankful in some areas of life. I am grateful to be living in a day with five kids, that there are such a thing as disposable diapers. I mean, I think there was a time when there was no such thing as disposable diapers. People used cloth diapers, and they had to wash them, possibly by hand. Grody! I mean, I think I would have invented disposable diapers if I lived in that day and age. But, you know, you just washed it and reused it. And I think some of you who lived in that time, some of you are shaking your head, probably wished you were living at an age where you could just simply wrap it up and throw it in the trash. And like I said, as a father with five boys, and I think some of you can concur, I thank God for disposable diapers. Don't you, Evan? Was it Evan that has a new baby? Justin? I think somebody just said testify, right? Yeah. All right. Maybe that's a prophetic word right there. I don't know. But some of you who have newer, you know, like you're still in that stage where you're going through and having diapers and so on, I'm sure you thank God you live in a day of disposable diapers. Now, I certainly appreciate the ease of disposability in some areas of life, but in our society, we have increasingly become used to viewing things as having very little to no intrinsic value. We simply see it for its utilitarian value. We come to view everything on a short-term basis, and that quickly becomes a way of life. It becomes a part of our natural DNA. It's a part of our culture. 30 years ago, Mattel, the toy company, came up with an interesting scheme to promote their latest version of their world-famous, and now it's world-famous, Barbie. The new Barbie was slimmer and more versatile than her predecessor. And in order to make the new Barbie more attractive and more basically to increase sales, Mattel said that for the first time in the history of their company, any girl wanting to purchase the new Barbie would receive a trade-in allowance for her old Barbie. Now, 30, 40 years ago, that was unheard of. Of course, what Mattel did not say was that by trading in the little girl's Barbie, her old doll, for a new and improved model, the little girl was learning something about the world in which she was growing up in. A world in which even things that you love and have developed deep sentimental value towards are becoming increasingly disposable. Quite a thought, isn't it? Here's a little girl pouring her affections, taking Barbie to church on Sunday, going out for tea with all of her little friends and their Barbies, toting her around to school and show and tell and dress up and taking her out on dates with Ken. And on and on, and all this love and time and affection and energy being poured into Barbie for years can all of a sudden now be replaced by a better model. Well, that was 30, 40 years ago, and since then, most of us have grown up breathing, swimming in a culture that has moved increasingly in a direction where the only mentality that we have is disposable. We now have disposable marriages, call it divorce, or, you know, no-fault divorces, or starter marriages. We have disposable babies, call that abortion. We're discussing the possibility of disposable old people, you call it euthanasia, physician-assisted suicides. And if asked why that is, the reason must be because we are in love with pain-free living. The pain-free life is the new god of our society. A god to be pursued at any cost. A god for whom anything and everything else can be sacrificed for. That, by the way, is why so many people have turned away from the God of the Bible. Because the God of the Bible obviously allows for some pain in our lives. And many people have decided that a God that would permit and allow and even appoint pain and difficulty and adversity in our lives is a God that we don't have the slightest interest in knowing. When the pain-free life becomes the ultimate goal of a society, or the ultimate value of the way that we live and pursue and define life and happiness and fulfillment, the strategy for pursuing it becomes very simple. When anything or anyone comes in a way of pain-free living or makes my life uncomfortable or makes me frustrated or discourages me, then I must get away from them or I must get away from it. And over a period of years, of decades, and perhaps years in your life, as this mentality becomes rooted deeper and deeper in the cultural psyche, more and more people feel rootless. We feel rootless because we move to new homes, we go to new schools, new jobs, new relationships, new churches, new friends. And every time we feel unhappy or misunderstood or hurt, we move on again and again and again. And so relationships in our culture become increasingly a means to an end to be enjoyed as long as they're comfortable. At the back end of that, you end up with more and more people who simply feel used and become increasingly cynical. That's the culture in which we live. I think that probably describes the way a lot of people feel living and working in New York City. I think that describes life in any major metropolitan type of arena. So how then do we learn to keep faith and maintain our commitments and learn what it means to make commitments in a disposable culture like that? How am I to respond to the difficult people in my life, the difficult people that God has placed there, either for me to reach, because he's called me to be on mission to reaching them, or the people that I have to work with because these are my co-laborers or my colleagues or my family members or my ministry partners. How am I to respond to some of these really difficult people when everything within me screams, take off? In a faith-breaking culture that values pain-free living, which results in disposable relationships, what is the Christian response? How do we honestly and genuinely say we love you, God, with all of our heart, with all of our mind, with all of our soul, with all of our strength, when there's something deep within us that does not want to love the people that he sends us to, or the people that he has placed in our lives? Well, let's travel back in time. Let's travel back in time to a world where it operated by a different set of values. A world where relationships were not disposable. I think the world of David, Saul, Jonathan, I think their lives and their story gives us some great insights. Some great values and virtues that we will want to translate into our own personal life and journey and make it a part of the way that we operate living in a faith-breaking culture. And you'll see that when God is at work in a person's life, we can develop a whole new set of values and relationships, a whole different approach to life. And I want to propose to you this. This is what Christians desperately need to discover if we're going to be people who are characterized by covenant, who's characterized by fidelity in an infidel, right? In a culture of infidelity, in a society that increasingly views all things as disposable. So let's begin with a quick overview of the Old Testament. If you have your Bible and you want to flip it over to 1 Samuel, you can kind of just keep it at chapter 9 because that's where we're going to end up. But let me give you a quick overview. God's people early on in 1 Samuel, they wanted a king. Now, you know, it was good reasons. We've been going through a book of Judges in our church, and the book of Judges is a horrible book. I don't know how many of you have read the book of Judges front to back. I define it or characterize the book of Judges as the worst book in the Bible. It is the worst book in the Bible. It's filled with the most like horrific stuff that you'll ever encounter. We read through the Bible. We're doing a read through the Bible as a family this year. And I'll tell you, man, as we're reading through the book of Judges, I don't know how much I actually have to quote-unquote paraphrase and rephrase things that are in that book. My 13-year-old, you know, for the first time was like hearing some of the things there, and his eyes were like wide open, like, why would anybody do that? He was like so grossed out and so shocked. It's one of the worst books in the Bible. And of course, there was no king, right? There was no king, and everybody did what was right in their own eyes. They defined their own morality. They defined their own standard of truth and absolutes. And of course, you know, we get to the book of Samuel, and you can understand why the nation wants a king. And God was not pleased with their desire because ultimately God was the king of his people, but they wanted a visible king, somebody that could lead them into battle and basically establish, you know, national dominance that could compete with all of the other superpowers of the day. And sometimes we want stupid things. We want things that God does not want for us, and that's the case here. The Lord's people had depended on God to deliver them in times of crisis, to lead them and deliver them from the hands of their enemies. Their defense had depended on God leading them into battle and giving them victory. But they had come to believe that was no longer a viable strategy. We can't just be a real nation, you know, if we're ruled by God. I mean, imagine going to, you know, the UN and saying, well, who's your representative? Well, God. I mean, I know you can't see him sitting there in a chair, but, you know, God's our representative. That doesn't really seem like that it's that intelligible. So they're like, this doesn't make sense. There was a growing demand in the nation for the stability that would come from a physical, visible king. And so in 1 Samuel chapter 8, verses 19 through 20, we read these words. We want a king over us, and then we will be like all the other nations. I mean, it's so funny, right? It sounds like kids, right? Kids want to, like, you know, wear what they wear, listen to what they listen, do what they want to do because they want to be like everybody else. It's funny. Nothing has changed over all of these thousands of years. Nothing essentially has changed about the nature of man. We want to be like all the other nations, which is ironic, especially when you think about the fact that God brought them out of slavery in Egypt so that they would not be like any of the other nations, right? Isn't that kind of funny? Like, you catch the irony there? God said, I'm setting you apart to be a holy nation, a royal priesthood, so that you will not be like any of the other nations who do what is right in their own eyes. And then, of course, here we get to 1 Samuel, and the nation of Israel wants to be just like everybody else. They want to be like the rest of the kids in the neighborhood, with a king to lead us and to go out before us and to fight our battles. Well, they persisted in wanting this until God finally just simply gives them what they want. Here's a huge principle for us to be aware of. Be very careful what you pursue and what you demand from God, because sometimes we can be so persistent that God gives us what we want even when it's not for our ultimate good. And so God gives them a king, precisely what they were after, and they got Saul. Saul was a tall, he was strong, he was a handsome man. He looked probably like Pastor Albert, a natural-born leader. He was a head taller than all of the other people. Now, this is exactly the kind of leader that they were looking for. They probably thought, my goodness, if the rest of the nations could see the kind of leader that we have, a foot taller than everybody else, then they know we will be a force to be reckoned with. So here we have one of the most frightening truths in the Bible, and that is, if we press hard enough, God sometimes will give us what we want. And Israel was determined to do something that was not in their best interest, but because they would not relent, God gave them what they wanted. In Psalm 106, verse 14 to 15 says this: but they lusted exceedingly in the wilderness and tempted God in the desert, and he gave them their request, but sent leanness into their soul. That is a frightening verse. It's a sobering verse. God gives his people what they continue to persist in demanding, and what they would not relent from pursuing, though it would lead to emptiness in their own soul, in their own heart, in their own body. That's a frightening reality. And some of us know what that is like. I wonder, I don't know where your life is this morning, but I wonder if some of us here may be pursuing some things that we know that it is not what God wants for us, but we are just, you know, we won't relent. And God gives us what we want, but what comes with it is a leanness, a void in our own soul. And some of us know what that is like, to get what we want and to ultimately discover to our chagrin that it didn't really satisfy our deepest need. They wanted the wrong thing, and how else is God to teach us sometimes, like children, when we want the wrong things, except to give us what we want and at some point allow us to see and to experience the bankruptcy of what it is that we ultimately desire. So God allows us to have it. And God allows Israel to have what they demand. Well, as we follow the story, sure enough, Saul turns out to be a disaster. The people realize soon enough that they made a very foolish choice, but now they have to live with the pain of their decision. Don't we all? Haven't we all? But in his mercy, God gives them relief from their pain. He told Samuel that the next king would come from another line, not from the line of Saul, but from another line, a new king who would have a heart for God. And of course, David wasn't a perfect leader. There's no such thing as a perfect leader. Nobody can ever be for you what you want them to be. Listen to that very carefully, particularly those of you who are married. Not even your spouse can always be for you what you want them to be. No president, no husband, no wife, no employer, no pastor, no small group leader, no worship team. But David was a man after God's own heart, and that was enough reason to be thankful for him. David was a gift from God out of his mercy to the people of Israel. And then from 1 Samuel 17 onwards, we read the story about the relationship between Saul and David, and how from the beginning, soon after the beginning of them meeting, Saul made David's life absolutely miserable. And of course, it all started in chapter 18. If you want to flip over there, you can. Keep your finger on chapter 9. It all started in chapter 18 after David slew Goliath, and then Saul made him and kept promoting him up the ranks of the military, and wherever David went, he was successful in his military campaigns. And the ladies, you know, on the worship team wrote a little ditty for him, and it went something like, "Saul has slain his thousand." Of course, Saul loved that. And David has slain his tens of thousands. Saul didn't like that much. And so Saul develops this spirit of jealousy towards David. So here's the question. Some of you will be able to relate to this. What do you do when you have a boss, a manager, a supervisor, somebody that is in charge over you who has a bitter attitude towards you? Any of you have ever experienced that? Yeah? So you're raising your hands. You ever work with somebody who has more seniority over you, that is jealous of your productivity and or your success? And they want to make your life absolutely miserable because they want that success for themselves, but they can't get it. And they're jealous of you and your competence and your achievement. Well, that's the situation that David is in. In fact, it got so bad that Saul hurled his spear at David on two separate occasions. And since it's never right to stay in a situation like that, in which your life is physically in danger, David went on a run. Now, here's the thing that I find absolutely staggering when I look at the story of Saul and David. David knew God had anointed him to be the king of Israel. He knew that Saul was a royal pain in the neck. David had the support of the people, and he could have easily seized power for himself. But he was loyal to Saul until the day that Saul died. And what's more, the day that Saul died, David wept for him. Now, I say that is absolutely staggering because that is so far from our culture. It is so foreign to our values that it is almost impossible to understand that reality. I think about all the situations that I know of and situations that I've been in. In fact, situations in which I find myself in even now, in which I and others have had to deal with Sauls in our lives, in my life, Sauls in your life. Some of you have Sauls in your offices. Some of you have a Saul in your family. Some of you have a Saul in your ministry team or in your neighborhood who lives next to you. For others of us, Saul is not so much a person, but a situation that God has allowed in your life. It is painful, and you want out. You want it gone. But God is, in his divine providence and sovereignty, placed him or it there. And so I ask you this question. As I live in a world that breaks peace, that breaks promises, how does David put up with Saul? How could he show this kind of loyalty for 15 years? How can I keep faith in a broken world and in a world of disposable relationships where disposable is the mentality that I look at the people around me with? How can I learn to be a person that is loyal? How do I cultivate the biblical value of loyalty when our culture has made disposability a kind of currency that has almost become virtuous? And you think about this. Companies will reward and promote those who are most willing to dispose of every attachment in their lives and to basically be at the company's behest 24/7, right? You guys understand that, living in New York City, working in New York City? So here's the first thing. Please turn with me to 1 Samuel chapter 10. Because this is where we discover the first principle on which loyalty is built. Look at verse 1. 1 Samuel chapter 10, verse 1. Then Samuel took a flask of oil and poured it on Saul's head and kissed him, saying, "Has not the Lord anointed you leader over his inheritance?" I want you to notice that word anointed. Saul was not a good king, but God anointed him to be king nonetheless. And God did that to teach the people through the consequences of their own foolish choice. But God is the one who anointed Saul. Miserable cuss that he was where he was according to the purposes of God. And he was in David's life, not by accident or incidentally, but by divine appointment. Now, if you turn over to Samuel, 1 Samuel 24, you'll see that David understood this. He understood it. And that's why he didn't take matters into his own hand. In 1 Samuel chapter 24, Saul has been hunting for David as a fugitive. He's been trying to kill him, and he's been chasing him all over kingdom come. And all of a sudden, at one point, the call of nature comes, and Saul's got to go and relieve himself. And back then, I guess they didn't have these porta pots, and so he snuck into a cave, and he has to kind of take off all of his armor and his suit and, you know, disrobe himself or whatever. And at that moment, David was in the back of that cave, and David could have easily just run a little knife right through his heart and ended it. But here's the reason that he gave for not doing that. Listen to what he says in 1 Samuel 24:6. "The Lord forbid that I should do such a thing to my master, the Lord's anointed, or lift my hand against him, for he is the anointed of the Lord." Do you see what he's saying? David is saying, "Saul, I can't take your life because God has put you where you are." David makes this statement, calling and recognizing Saul as the anointed. He uses that word 7 times in this short little passage. 7 times he uses the word anointed. Now we have a word to describe the fact that God orders the events and the circumstances and even the people in our lives, and he places them according to his purpose, and that's the word providence. Very simply, providence is the way in which God wisely and lovingly orders the ultimate good of his own people. That's what providence is. It's taught throughout the Bible, but the most familiar verse, and many of you will know it, is Romans 8:28. The Bible makes it very clear, and David understood this, that your life and my life is not a random series of accidental or coincidental events. The sequence of things that occur are ordered by the hands of God. And God has a wonderful way of orchestrating all of our circumstances and relationships together to advance his ultimate purpose for us, which is not that you or I would have a pain-free life. That is not God's ultimate purpose. His ultimate purpose for you, for every one of his people, is that we would reflect the life and the beauty of Jesus Christ to the glory of God for all of eternity. And folks, let's be realistic. That often is more powerfully displayed, not through our victories, but through our failures and through those moments where we feel we are crushed. Where we feel we are crushed. Have you noticed, by the way, when you eat herbs and when you eat food, we're Chinese people, we love eating, don't we? But when I love cooking. And but have you noticed, like, whenever you're cooking and you're working with ingredients and so on, right? When you crush something, whether it's peppers or oregano or garlic, the odor really comes out of it, doesn't it? Especially like garlic. We love garlic, right? But you take like this gigantic clove of garlic and you just walk up to it and you go, that smells okay, but you can't really smell it. But you know what happens when you take that and you put it in a garlic press and you just squeeze that thing and this whole garlic clove becomes just minced and all the juices run out and all of a sudden all that flavor comes out. Folks, the beauty and the glory of Jesus Christ in us in jars of clay, it is most aromatically, most powerfully emitted, not in our successes, in what we think are our successes. The flavor, the aroma of the gospel, the beauty and the glory and the flavor of Jesus Christ in us comes out like when our lives are like in that garlic press called adversity, and all of a sudden it gets squeezed more and more and more, and that's when the glory of Christ is emitted from us. Can we understand that? Can we appreciate that? Can we grasp that and find confidence in that? That God puts people in our lives that make us miserable and circumstances that we would much rather get out of, because that is the garlic press that he has put you in to squeeze out the flavor and the aroma of Jesus out of you. God works in everything for our ultimate good, for his ultimate glory. Now, if we can begin to grasp that our life is not a haphazard, randomly arbitrary collision of circumstances and people, but ordered by the loving hand of God with an eternal purpose in mind, then we will have a whole different attitude about the Sauls that he puts in our lives. Look at how this gets worked out in reality. Chapter 9, flip back over there. We'll read this. This is a great, great story here. There was a Benjamite, a man of standing, whose name was Kish, son of Abiel, the son of Zeror, son of Bechorath, the son of Aphia of Benjamin. He had a son named Saul, and an impressive young man without equal among the Israelites, a head taller than any of the others. Now the donkeys belonging to Saul's father, Kish, were lost, and Kish said to his son, Saul, take one of the servants with you and go and look for the donkeys. Now, I'm just picturing this as I read. He wakes up one morning. He's sitting at the kitchen, eating kitchen table. He just poured himself a bowl of Frosted Flakes, and he's thinking about his schedule for the day. He's got classes, and then, after school, he's got, some tutoring that he needs to get done, and then he gets to go off to football practice, and then he's looking forward to hanging out with the guys at Red Robin for some burgers and fries, and then after that, he's going to get home and get his homework done and then do some of the chores, and he's got his whole day that he's planning out ahead of him, and all of a sudden dad walks into the kitchen and says, son, got some bad news. Those donkeys got loose from the barn again, and I need you to go and find them. And Saul probably heaved this big sigh, like just about any teenager, Any of you guys have teenagers? You tell your teenager you got a job for them to do. You know what their first response is? Why me? I hear this every single day. You know, like, why can't he do it? Because I asked you. That's why. If I want him to do it, I would ask him. And he's probably like, you know, I can just picture it. I mean, he's a typical teenager. And Saul probably heaved his big sigh, as you or I probably would when somebody asks us to do something we don't want to do. Because where do you begin looking for donkeys? I mean, escaped donkeys. I mean, fortunately, we don't have this problem living in New York City. But he goes out and he's probably thinking to himself, what a stupid, meaningless day this is turning out to be. You know, I've never had to hunt for donkeys. I've never had to, fortunately. And assuming none of you have either. But I used to work in an accounting department when I was in college, my college years. I worked in an accounting department because I thought I was going to go into accounting. And I remember having to hunt down a penny in order to reconcile the general ledger. And man, it would take me hours to figure out like where this one penny was off. And I remember sitting there going, I'm going to kill myself. You know, can I just like take a penny out or put one of my own pennies in and fix this problem? It was like the most frustrating and tedious work in the world. It felt like an exercise in futility. I mean, who cares about a penny, right? Who cares about a penny? You ever have that feeling when you're at work? You ever feel like your work is like that? You feel like your job is like that? Then you can identify with Saul here. He's looking for donkeys in the middle of nowhere. Look at verse 4. So he passed through all the hill country of Ephraim, through the area of Shalisha, but they did not find them. They went on into the district of Shalem, but the donkeys were not there. Then he passed through the territory of Benjamin. They did not find them there. And when they reached the district of Zuph, Saul said to the servant who was with him, come, let's go back. Otherwise, Dad's going to start getting worried more about us than about the donkeys. And the servant replied, look, in this town there's a man of God. He's highly respected, and everything he says come true. Let's go and ask him where these donkeys are. And Saul goes, that's a great idea, but we don't have anything to offer to him. Like, we've got no gifts. And the servant says in verse 10, 8, look, I've got a quarter of a shekel of silver. I'll give it to the man of God, and he will tell us, you know, what way to take to find these donkeys. And verse 10, Saul says, hey, that's a great idea. So it's a great suggestion by his servant. Comes up with some great advice. You've got problems, you know what to do. Go talk to the pastor. Which, by the way, don't go talk to the pastor. We usually don't have any idea. He's a prophet. He's not a pastor. And God had already told the prophet that previously that, you know, there's going to be someone who's going to come looking for you tomorrow. And when that person comes, I want you to appoint that guy as king. And so here Saul begins his day. He's got his plans ahead of him for what he wants to do. It gets completely interrupted and ruined by this meaningless task. He's wasted the entire day looking for a needle in a haystack. And the day ends with Saul anointed by the time you get to chapter 10, verse 1. It ends with Saul being anointed as the first king of Israel. But do you remember how it started, right? We read about him being anointed as the first king, and we're like, wow, that's phenomenal. Can you imagine how he felt? Right. It'd be like you coming into your office, and all of a sudden you got promoted to be like manager or to be boss or superintendent or, you know, executive director, when you had no idea or wasn't even planning on that. I mean, imagine like the joy or the excitement that you might feel. But the day started with him looking for some dumb, lost donkeys. The point is this, is that even in the most aggravating circumstances that are outside of our control, that we would rather not be in, God, in his providential care, is ordaining the people and the places and the circumstances. He's ordering them. God is at work even in the tiniest things of our life and in the people that he has placed in it. They are not there by accident. I want you to stop and just think about the people in your life, the people that you really love, the people that just fill you up, make you happy, make you glad. They bring joy to your life. They're like, they energize you. Does everybody have somebody like that in their life? Everybody? I mean, if you have somebody like that, can I just see a show of hand? You got people in your life that really like just float your boat, put wind in your sail? Yeah? Okay, do you have people who are the exact opposite, who take the wind out of your sail, who are a pain in your neck and make your life miserable, and you go, man, why are they put on this earth other than to just make me miserable? You guys have anybody like that in your life? Yeah, show of hands? Yeah? Oh, okay. All right, cool. Well, you know, God placed them in your life. He may have placed them in your family. He may have placed them in your church. He may have placed them in your office. He might have placed them on your ministry team. He might have placed them in the sphere of influence of people that he's called you to reach out to and be missional towards. And so here's the thing. Look, we may have a wonderful family that we grow up in. We may have a wonderful experience in our church family. But some of us may have grown up in very dysfunctional families. And some of us, when we think of family, when we think of like those close relationships to us, there's more pain than joy. There's more grief and disappointment than there is, you know, excitement. When I was like, do you have people that fill your sails? You know, it'd be great if all of those were like our family members. But when I asked you the next question, are there people who take the wind out of jail? For some of us, those are our family members. They may be our kids. They may be our spouse. They may be our parents. They may be our boss. And even if those ones that are closest to us are the ones that are just a pain in our neck, God will even use them and the experience that you are going through with that person as a part of his ultimate purpose for making you like Jesus Christ. There are even valuable lessons that can be learned from the most dysfunctional family and relationships. The place where you are, do you think that you are there by accident? Well, Acts 17 tells us that the exact time and place where we live and work and live among has been planned by God. It's in Acts 17. And when we understand that we are not here by accident, but by the purpose and design of God, that transforms our attitude and our perspective. God has placed this person next to my cubicle, that one as my roommate, this one in my family, and that person in my church. My goodness, God is involved in all of this. And that's where loyalty begins. Because loyalty understands divine providence. Loyalty understands that God's providence is at work in all of my life. Think about the Garden of Eden, where the very first marriage took place. Marriage, what's that all about? Was it that Adam went wandering around the island and found some of the others? Met this woman named Eve from this other group. She's rather cute, so I'll ask her to marry me? No. Specifically says that God created the woman, brought her to the man, he joins their hand, and then enjoins them to do life together. And that is the basis for loyalty in a marriage. It is not just for me when I think about my wife, which, by the way, 20 years ago today, I was getting married. So this weekend is my 20th anniversary. The reason why I am still married and the reason why I married my wife is not just because I thought she was cute and beautiful. She is. It's got to be more than that. God is in it. God is in it. And when I know that God is in it, I've got the basis for loyalty in my relationships and in my commitments. Your work. Do you simply see your work as something that you have to do in order so that you can do what you want to do? Or can you see it as something God has gifted you, shaped you, wired you, and made you to be able to make a specific contribution, whether it is studying or trading in a marketplace or programming or teaching or whatever it is that you do? God made me to do this. And he's put me in his place to do it. So let me do it to his glory. See, that kind of perspective and attitude breeds loyalty even when we live in a culture and work in a culture that values disposability and what's the opposite word of reward? Disrewards, disincentivizes loyalty. See, that kind of attitude breeds loyalty. I thank God, even as I thought about his providence in my life, you think about God's providence in your life. I look back over my life. God took me out of I was born in Vietnam, by the way. I don't know if any of you remember that from a couple of years ago, but I was born in Vietnam in the middle of the Vietnam War. But having said that, my dad was an incredibly wealthy man in Vietnam. He was a businessman, and he made a great living. And we lived in our own building. And had I grown up there, I would have inherited all of that. I would have enjoyed all of the luxury and privileges that all of that wealth and position that my father had would have brought with it. I lost the opportunity to inherit my father's wealth. And instead, I received an eternal inheritance through Jesus Christ. That's providence. That's the perspective of providence. I lost my home, my country, the place where I would have established my personal and ethnic identity. And for years, I grew up in a culture where I resented being different from all of the other kids that were around me. But because of that, I was driven to find my ultimate and truest identity in Christ. Not in being Asian or American, but in Christ. He put me in a family, and that has great privileges, but it also means I have some responsibility to the people in that family, whether it's the one that I grew up in or the one that I am growing up. God placed me in a local church, and that gives me a responsibility to the people that he has put in my life in that local church. I think about the Sauls in all of these areas, the Sauls in my home, the Sauls among my relatives and in my workplace and in my church. And I think, were they there by accident or did God place them there? If I can't see that God is involved and using my circumstances and the people in my life to make me more like Jesus, then I am not going to be able to live and deal with the Sauls in my life. I will simply operate with a mentality that these people too are disposable. And sometimes we get the idea that good things come from the hand of God, but difficulties are beyond God's reach. You ever feel that way? But we need to understand more deeply that God works all things, even including our foolish choices and our deep disappointments and our painful relationship. He is at work right there so that we might look up to him and say, oh God, help me right now in this to learn what you would want to teach me so that I might become more like Christ and not go through this pain without something that glorifies you coming out of it and being produced in me. God, let me not go through this without your image of Jesus, the image and the person of Jesus being glorified and more clarified in me. David understood providence, and that was the secret to his loyalty, which our culture desperately needs to see. And where will we see that kind of loyalty if we are not going to find it among the people of God? If we can't see this kind of loyalty in the church, where are we going to find it, folks? It's not difficult to identify the Sauls in our lives. But my prayer is that God would help us to see how he can use the Saul in my life and in your life to advance the image of Christ in us to his glory for that ultimate purpose. Our life is not at the impulse of arbitrary forces. It is in the hands of God, and the hand that governs the world is the same hand that holds your life. Would you bow with me in a word of prayer? Father, if you only gave us blessings, if our life was possible to be completely orchestrated and defined and constructed as we would desire, we would become addicted to pain-free living. We would become idolaters. Thank you that you are wiser than that, and you know precisely what you are doing in every circumstance in every one of our lives here this morning. And some of us here would honestly have to admit that we are not sure what you're up to, and we may not even like what you're up to. But because we believe the scriptures and we trust you, we would dare to believe that you are good and that you are perfecting the beauty of Jesus in us right now on into all of eternity. And if the Saul in our life is a part of that, then help us to respond as David did, to be different from the world that runs from every problem and from every person that makes our life difficult, so that we might begin to reflect the grace of Jesus Christ by being people who keep faith in a disposable culture. For your grace and help in this pursuit, we bring our request to Jesus, and in his name we ask these things. Amen.